Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner, bringing you an hour of news, history, commentary, and information about the African American community. This week I'll have four readings, two from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper, one from ESPN magazine, and I'm starting with this. America's longest black-owned radio station celebrates 75 years in Kansas City. This appeared in the Kansas City Star newspaper and was written by J.M. Banks and published March 27, 2025. By the time the sun rises each weekday morning, radio host Brian Brooks is already in the studio at KPRS radio station, preparing to greet Kansas City over the airwaves, a routine he's maintained for over two decades. Known to his listeners as Brian B. Shinin, Brooks sets up his soundboard, adjusts his microphone, and arranges his playlist, ready to continue the long-standing tradition of black radio that KPRS has upheld for 75 years. Alongside his co-host, Deanna Perry, who is known on the air as Deanna Hustle, the duo hosts the Hustle and Shine in the Morning show on Hot 103.3 Jams. Despite the early start, they maintain a deep sense of duty to honor the station's legacy, ensuring that even if they are not feeling their best some mornings, the daily goal is to always deliver a high-quality show. "We come in here every morning and we are the first voice a lot of people hear," said Brooks. "So even if I'm tired or sick, I still have to come in here and give it everything no matter what." Together, Brooks and Perry are part of a proud tradition of radio personalities at this Kansas City station who have built lasting connections with their audience. It's that relationship that has allowed KPRS to, over the many years, maintain its identity as the People's Radio Station. This year's 75th anniversary marks a significant milestone for KPRS as the oldest continuously black-owned radio station in the United States. For decades, the station has played a pivotal role in shaping the local community, fostering talented personalities and promoting initiatives that have contributed to the growth and evolution of Kansas City. The next section of the article is titled, "How It Started." The Carter Broadcast Group, which owns the KPRS station, has been run by the Carter family since its inception. President and CEO Mike Carter was raised in the station and got an early start in the business. At the age of 8, Carter joined the radio team with his own show. From then on, he has carried the legacy and traditions of his family. "My grandfather was an engineer by trade," Carter said, during a recent interview with the Star. "He built his own radio when he was in college, and in 1948, he wrote an article to Radio and Records about the lack of black-owned radio stations. His grandfather was contacted by Alf Landon, the then governor of Kansas, who donated an old 500-watt transmitter to Carter. With Landon's help, KPRS 1590 AM aired for the first time in 1950. Carter Broadcast still has that AM channel airing gospel music and has broadcast on several other local channels, including 106.1 FM and R&B 106.9. KPRS has played a crucial role in not only promoting black music genres such as gospel, rhythm and blues, jazz, and hip-hop, but it has also served as a platform for social justice. Despite overcoming numerous challenges over the years, the station has continued to serve as a source of empowerment for Kansas City's black community. Its history is deeply connected to the city's media landscape and its efforts to promote social change. From the civil rights era of the 1960s to the Black Lives Matter movement in recent years. A year after the first broadcast, KPRS moved into its first studio home established in 1951 by Andrew Skip Carter. It was a big deal for black listeners in Kansas City to have a daytime AM station alternative to the white-owned radio stations. KPRS played music by black artists and talked about issues of particular interest to members of black families, educators, business owners, and more. Carter remembers the many stories his grandfather would share about the early days of the station and how difficult it was for a black man to get ahead. That didn't stop him from continuing to build the community bonds he needed to grow the station. In 1963, KPRS received its FM radio license and, with a consistent lineup of R&B music, quickly gained a loyal following. The station became the destination for community leaders, politicians, and preachers looking to get their message out. "I felt honored to be able to carry on this legacy," Carter said. "I think the mission has stayed the same, and that is to serve the community." Skip started the station to be a voice for the Black community. Today, in addition to the Kansas City station, the Carter family owns several other radio broadcast outlets across Missouri and Kansas. "Listeners have stayed loyal," Carter said, and he's thankful they keep tuning in even when other options are available. He said he believes in the community trust built over the decades and thinks it's what will push the organization forward over the next 75 years. The next section of the article is titled, "A Community Anchor." Myron Fears, 59, the creative director of KPRS, has been an integral part of the station since 1988. The first day he walked into the office, which at the time was located in Midtown near Crown Center, he was amazed to see a station occupied and run by a majority Black staff. He fell in love right away with not only radio, but KPRS, and has dedicated his career to the station and its mission. Starting as an intern and later transitioning to an on-air personality, Fears, who has been with the station over 40 years, worked his way up to become a leader, shaping the station's programming and fostering valuable partnerships with community organizations like the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime and the Samuel U. Rogers Health Center. "I think the history of the station is what sets us apart," said Fears. "This is the first Black-owned radio station west of the Mississippi River, and we have become an institution for the community, like a church, like a school or a hospital." The year before Fears joined KPRS, the station had transitioned to full automation, meaning that shows and music were pre-recorded and played back on air. But shortly after he started working there in 1988, a shift in management ushered in a new era for KPRS and a return to live broadcasts. According to Fears, when Mike Carter took the helm in 1987, the station went back to live programming. The goal was to provide real-time updates to listeners and create a stronger, more personal connection between the station and its audience. Fears, who hosted his radio show under the name Myron D., became part of a new lineup that would introduce beloved personalities such as Tony G, Sean Tyler, and Julie Jones, voices that many Kansas Cityans grew up listening to. "I think us being fully automated from 1973 to 1987 really hurt us with the listeners. But when I joined, they were bringing in new people and it brought in a different spark of energy," Fears said. As a member of the Black community who understood the value placed on community connections, Fears recognized that the radio station was deeply woven into the fabric of Black culture in Kansas City. Black residents turned to KPRS not only for music, but also to stay informed about local developments that were often overlooked by mainstream media. Fears said the station leadership has always felt that KPRS had a deep responsibility to its listeners and viewed its role as more than just providing music for their morning and evening commutes. "We started working with community leaders from all areas," said Fears. "We did work with Samuel Rogers in regards to healthcare, and we had Alvin Brooks come on from the Ad Hoc Group talking about gun violence and missing children." To celebrate the station's 75th anniversary and its decades of service to the metro area, Kansas City PBS released a documentary titled Diamond Jubilee, a 75-year celebration of Carter Broadcast. The radio station has a long-standing tradition of taking a stand within the community, especially as it relates to the evolving landscape of music performed primarily by Black artists. R&B, the blues, rap, and hip-hop. In the 1990s, a debate emerged at KPRS over the rise of gangster rap and the negative stereotypes many felt it imposed on the Black community. In 1995, the station made the controversial decision to stop playing hip-hop that glorified gang violence and featured overtly sexualized lyrics. "I think we have always asked ourselves, how do we best serve the community," said Fears. "I think then we struggled with how do we make sure we are promoting the music without promoting all the other stuff." Over time, and as the genre gained broader acceptance in mainstream American culture, the station eased its restrictions on hip-hop. The station, rebranded as Hot 103.3 Jams in the 1990s, embraced hip-hop culture. In the early 2000s, KPRS launched a late-night show called Underground Heat, which gave local hip-hop artists the opportunity to get their music aired on the radio, giving many of them a platform for the very first time. The station's audience grew. One notable addition was Generation Rap, a Saturday show that brought together youth from across the Kansas City metro area to discuss social and political issues of the day from a teen's perspective. Brian Busy Benton, one of the young contributors, got his first taste of a public life through this program. Known in Kansas City these days for curating the popular social media group KC Where You At and launching 816 Day, Benton credits his time at the station for sparking his passion for community outreach. Being on the radio was huge, said Benton. It was great because we were able to talk about social issues and it allowed teens a platform to hear about the issues that related to them. Benton, 40, recalls that growing up, KPRS was more than just another station on the dial. He remembers gathering with family and friends to listen to their favorite radio personalities every day. He believes the station played a crucial role in shaping how people viewed their city, instilling a strong sense of pride in being part of its story. As a former Generation Rap cast member, Benton feels that having a program focused on youth was attractive to a younger demographic and pulled them toward the station. I think when most people my age think about KPRS, they remember all of the good they have done in the community and all the work they have done to build up the community here in Kansas City, he said. While Benton has observed young audiences shift away from radio, here and elsewhere around the country due to the rise of the internet, he believes KPRS still holds respect and relevance because of its long-standing commitment to serving the community. The high-energy show, Hustle and Shine in the Morning with Brooks and Perry, doesn't stray from the Community Commitment Foundation that has kept the station going for so long. The show covers all things KC and features a mix of popular music, along with discussions on politics, sports, and community news. Brooks and Perry shine a spotlight on Black creatives and entrepreneurs who otherwise go unrecognized for their contributions to the metro. The show features weekly addresses from Mayor Quentin Lucas, who updates listeners on key issues and developments in the city. Social media and the internet has changed the way people listen to music, Brooks said. I think our presentation has to stay relevant with people's listening styles, so we have to learn how to evolve. The final section of the article is titled, Into the Future. Brooks, a Kansas City native, grew up listening to KPRS, but never imagined he would one day become one of the station's most senior personalities. He started there in 2006. Over the years, he amassed a large and dedicated fan base, including significant numbers on social media. I felt like I was carrying the torch that Tony G passed to me, that Myron and Julie Jones passed to me. All these generations that mean a lot to Kansas City. To be a part of that lineage and history means a lot to us, Brooks said. Perry, originally from St. Louis, joined the station in 2020 and quickly fell in love with the city and its people. Although she wasn't initially familiar with the station's history, she has since seen how integral it is to the community. As a result, she feels a deep sense of responsibility to continue the tradition of community involvement that KPRS has established. I do have a huge sense of pride working for the oldest continually Black-ran station in the country, said Perry. That history is something I don't take lightly, and I am very much honored. People see me out all the time and ask for a picture, and I am always so thankful because these people are listening and may not know our faces, but they know our voices, and that means a lot to me, Perry said. Brooks said the station's ongoing drive to stay at the forefront of community media is key to its continued success in the future. We are one of the original forms of mass media along with print. We have been told that nobody listens to radio anymore. For the past 30 years, we have had to go through changes, and I guess I think for me, I just want to see it grow as much as possible as a station. Fears, who has been with the station for over 30 years, believes its mission is just as crucial today as it was in the 1960s, and doesn't think its impact will diminish. He is optimistic that the station's commitment and positive influence will ensure its legacy continues to thrive and stay relevant for years to come. "I think as long as we keep the community first, we will always have a place in the Kansas City media landscape," said Fears. "We have been instrumental in the cultural makeup of Kansas City, and I am excited for the station to support the city for the next 75 years. That was the article titled, "America's Longest Black-Owned Radio Station Celebrates 75 Years in Kansas City." It was written by J.M. Banks and published March 27, 2025, in the Kansas City Star newspaper. My next story is about the intersection of sports and culture. The title is, "Harry Edwards Isn't Done Just Yet." It was written by Michael A. Fletcher and published March 5, 2025, at the ESPN.com website. The letter was a venomous tirade, dripping with racist vitriol. The greeting started with a slur, "Harry Liverlips Edwards," and labeled black students as stupid subhuman scum. The one-page missive predicted that the Black Power movement would lead the country into a race war. Signed by National Front, a white supremacist group, the letter came to Harry Edwards in the late 1960s just as his demands for equal rights for black athletes were gaining widespread attention. As a professor at what was then called San Jose State College, Edwards spearheaded the Olympic Project for Human Rights, which called for black athletes to boycott the 1968 Olympics. Although the boycott never materialized, the group's efforts culminated in the iconic moment when American sprinters Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their black glove fist in protest on the Olympic medal stand at the 1968 Mexico City Games. The death threats, hate mail, and intimidation attempts have failed to dwarf Edwards' meaningful impact over the past 60 years, making him arguably the strongest advocate for black athletes in history. He has inspired protest and counseled countless athletes, including former San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick, whose 2016 demonstrations against police brutality rocked the sports world and polarized the nation. He also has been a valued consultant to team owners and sports leagues executives, including NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, working to craft programs to diversify their management ranks and provide off-field support to players. Now age 82 and stricken by cancer in his bone marrow, thyroid, and prostate, Edwards still sounds robust but is resigned to what's ahead. "My bone marrow is not producing enough red blood cells, and eventually it will cease to produce enough to supply my major organs," he said. "At that point, it's over. And that's assuming that the prostate cancer doesn't get to me beforehand. But you know what? This is part of the deal on this planet. Nobody gets out of life alive." A towering presence both physically and intellectually, Edwards helps shatter the once pervasive myth that sports are somehow exempt from society's ills. "It became clear to me that sports were so intertwined with society that, institutionally, it was a reiteration of the structure and dynamics of human and institutional relationships in society," he said. "And therefore, there was the potential of leveraging sports to generate change." He's pledging to fight for justice as long as he can. Edwards moved gingerly, leaning on a black cane as he stepped into a room at the 49ers' offices next to Levi's Stadium. His 6'8" frame still commanded attention, even as time has etched itself into his gait. On this February day, he was dressed head to toe in his signature black. He exuded a focused intensity. But beneath the armor was a teacher's warmth, accessible and patient, eager to illuminate forgotten stories from the past that help explain the present. Cancer has caused episodes of stabbing pain in his right shin, hips, and pelvis, slowing his stride. He also had just wrenched a knee, the kind of injury that comes with the years. "I don't know what happened," he said, his deep voice softened to a small smile. Age, he joked, has a way of catching up with even the fiercest of fighters. He settled at a light-colored table and unfurled history, both personal and collective. He talked about athletes who dared to speak out and the price they paid for their defiance. For generations, society had celebrated sports as a refuge, a place to cheer and forget. He also knew that sports figures started protesting long before his own rise as an activist and member of the Black Panther Party in the 1960s. And he understood the backlash they triggered was often swift and brutal. He spoke of Octavius Cato, who saw baseball as a bridge across the nation's racial divide, but was denied in his attempt to have his all-black team play in a forerunner to the major leagues in the years after the Civil War. Cato was shot dead by a white rioter in 1871 while organizing black voters in Philadelphia. Edwards invoked Irashana Rose Robinson, a high jumper who, incensed by Jim Crow, refused to stand for the national anthem at the 1959 Pan American Games, only to find herself arrested on tax evasion charges 6 months later. Wilma Rudolph, the star sprinter who returned from the 1960 Olympics with 3 gold medals, demanded that officials in her hometown of Clarksville, Tennessee, desegregate a parade to be held in her honor. They agreed, but Rudolph paid a steep price for her audacity. As a consequence, in her own country, she was canceled, constricted, restricted, Edwards said. It was the price that she paid for having the commitment to say we as Americans are better than this. Many things have changed over time, he said, but activism always comes with a price and a surcharge. When Kaepernick kneeled during the national anthem to protest ongoing racism, Edwards said, he never counseled him on what to do. But he did warn Kaepernick that critics would distort his protest and denounce him as un-American, regardless of whether it was true or not. People who hate this country so much that they would disrespect the flag would not go out on a limb and make themselves vulnerable in that regard, Edwards said. I said, Cap, don't worry about what these people are saying. They would have the same reaction to you if you were in street clothes and took a knee on the sidewalk to the playing of Chopsticks and said, this is in protest. Edwards has felt similar repercussions. Proof is contained in many of the documents in his archives, which span 18 boxes at San Jose State University's main library. The collection includes unhinged hate mail and a copy of an FBI poster featuring Edwards wearing black shades and a black Kango cap, headlined, Armed and Dangerous. There is a letter written in the months following the renowned Smith-Carlos protest by Avery Brundage, International Olympic Committee president, to Pedro Ramirez Vasquez, chairman of the Mexico City Organizing Committee. The note excoriated Ramirez Vasquez for including images of the protest in the film documenting the games. It was very disturbing to have you confirm the rumors that have reached my ears about the use of pictures of the nasty demonstration against the United States flag by Negroes, read the letter dated August 19, 1969. As you know, the reaction was immediate and the culprits were sent home at once. It was clear Brundage saw the true offense as the act of protest, not the injustice that provoked it. But Edwards has long since made peace with such hostility. He sees it as the first step on the road to his goal, which is to transform opponents into allies. Unless our strategic change efforts involve converting critics and adversaries into collaborators and advocates, then what are we struggling for? He asked. Edwards' determination was forged amid hardship in his hometown of East St. Louis, Illinois. He was raised in the all-black Southland neighborhood still haunted by a 1917 massacre during which roving white mobs killed hundreds of black residents and forced thousands of others from their homes. Edwards grew up hearing the stories, whispered reminders of the homes torched, families slaughtered. Old folks would still be talking about, yeah, that vacant lot over there is where Mr. Howard's house was, he said. And that's where the Johnson girls were burned alive because they ran in there to hide from the people who were killing black folks in the street. Edwards was the second of 8 children, and his family's financial struggles grew dire when his mother, fed up with her husband, left home when he was 8. His father worked 2 jobs, but that was not enough to prevent Edwards and his siblings from slipping into what he called the community's chaotic underfooting. They sometimes went hungry, and often were forced to survive by their own wits. In his 1980 memoir, The Struggle That Must Be, Edwards wrote that in grade school, he once was asked by a teacher to write an essay about the importance of newspapers. He said they helped him keep warm. Newspapers are important because we use them to start fire in the front room heater in the kitchen stove, and because in the winter, we wrap them around our legs, stuff them into the linings and sleeves of our coats, put them between the blankets on our beds, and place them folded layer upon layer in our shoes when the soles had worn too thin, he wrote. His parents tried unsuccessfully to reconcile at one point, and when Edwards was 13, his mother returned to get her children. But Edwards stayed behind with his father, a one-time aspiring prize fighter who worked various low-wage jobs, including as a laborer at a local chemical plant. Edwards was already a star high school athlete, and his father pushed him to use sports as a ticket out. A family friend had always regaled him with stories about the possibilities of college and of California, where Edwards' grandmother lived. So when he graduated from high school, the family friend bought him a train ticket to California, where he moved in with his grandmother and enrolled at Fresno City College. There, he joined the track team and was an immediate star. More important to his life's journey, he became interested in reading and learning. The more I read, the more excited I became. I soon found that there was a message, a story, somebody's point of view implicit in every book I had been assigned, he wrote in his memoir. I had learned to read critically, and unless one is reading critically, one is not reading at all. An athletic scholarship brought him to San Jose State, where he set a school record in the discus and captained the basketball team. But the blatant racism black athletes faced on campus quickly soured him. White students hurled racial epithets at black students if they happened upon fraternity row. Black students were discouraged from attending some of the school dances. And the school's housing office gave white students the option of choosing not to live with black roommates in dormitories. Black students were never offered a choice. In his early days on campus, Edwards overheard two white guys in the locker room denigrating black athletes, saying they always choke under pressure. Only later did he learn that they were assistant coaches. His breaking point came during a heated confrontation with his track coach, which ended with Edwards leaving the team before the end of his sophomore year. He said he never picked up a discus again, but was able to keep his scholarship because he continued as a basketball player. When Edwards graduated in 1964, he drew interest from the Minnesota Vikings and San Diego Chargers, as well as the Los Angeles Lakers. But he decided to accept a Woodrow Wilson Fellowship to attend Cornell University. There he earned a master's degree and eventually a doctorate in an entirely new discipline, the sociology of sport. Edwards recalled that when he presented his thesis idea to the three faculty members on his doctoral committee, they were dismissive. To a man, they said, there is no such thing as the sociology of sport. I said, that's why I want to do it, because I think that we're missing something in terms of our analysis of social structure and social change, Edwards said. The committee members were reluctant, but eventually relented. Still, Edwards said, they warned him, you're going to be laughed out of the discipline. Despite that, Edwards thrived at Cornell and enjoyed the academic camaraderie among graduate students there. On several weekends, he took the four-hour bus ride to New York City to attend meetings of Malcolm X's Organization of Afro-American Unity. More than merely stimulating new ideas for me, Malcolm X incited, inflamed, and legitimized a passion to act upon deeply felt convictions, Edwards wrote. While working on his dissertation, he returned to San Jose State to work as a part-time instructor and immerse himself in the growing Black Power movement. In the fall of 1967, the atmosphere at San Jose State simmered with tension, and before long he emerged as a voice for Black students who had long endured the indignities of racism on campus. Edwards and a coalition of student activists presented a list of grievances to university officials, demanding, among other things, an increase in Black faculty, the recruitment of more Black students, the desegregation of social life on campus, When their concerns were met with indifference, they issued a bold ultimatum. Unless action was taken, they would disrupt the upcoming football game. The threat worked. The game was canceled, and the demands were addressed, proving that sports could be a powerful lever for social change. When you look back at what he was saying in the 1960s, it was really not anything more than common sense, said Richard Lapchick, founder of the Institute for Sport and Social Justice at the University of Central Florida. If you're going to have a society that has racial justice, you needed to do what Harry was talking about. It made sense to use the sports platform as a vehicle to get people's attention who might not otherwise pay attention to these issues. The effort thrust Edwards into the spotlight, which only intensified with his role in the Olympic protest. His defiance made him a target, but it also catapulted him into a kind of celebrity status. Dozens of news stories chronicled his rise and his insights on the intersection of sports and society. He received letters from soldiers stationed overseas, from athletes, and from ordinary citizens, each one a testament to the growing reach of his message. After earning his doctorate in 1973, he began teaching at the University of California, Berkeley, where his sociology classes packed large lecture halls with hundreds of students. For all his budding fame, Edwards always remained grounded and determined to separate his personal life from his activist work. He married his wife, Sandra, nearly 55 years ago, and he raised his three children in a home in Fremont, California, where he and his wife still live. Early on, he said, he and his wife agreed to keep his work separate from their personal life, a pledge he said he is proud to have always fulfilled. Through the years, Edwards said he was careful to ensure that his activism be more than symbolic. He wanted it to force tangible change. That meant working with sports leagues, coaches, and team owners, the types of people who were once targets of his protests. In the mid-1980s, he became a player liaison and mentor with the Golden State Warriors. Around the same time, he began a long association as a consultant with the 49ers, a role that developed after he and then-coach Bill Walsh struck up a relationship. It was the start of a close friendship that the two men shared until Walsh's death in 2007. Everything and anything that is said or discussed between us, including the fact of even having had a discussion, for my part will stay between us, Edwards wrote to Walsh in May 1986. I believe that you will find that my loyalty to friends tends toward the absolute, even as I am honest and straightforward in my private conversations and relations with them. Edwards helped Walsh establish a development pipeline for black coaches that later morphed into the NFL's Bill Walsh Diversity Coaching Fellowship. The program allows aspiring coaches to observe NFL training camps and off-season workouts to hone their craft. Through the years, the program has turned out a slew of future black head coaches, including Lovie Smith, Marvin Lewis, Leslie Frazier, Anthony Lynn, Mike Tomlin, and Raheem Morris. The two also persuaded the 49ers to develop programs to help players manage off-field issues and prepare for their lives after football. It proved to be a significant step toward moving teams closer to valuing the humanity of players, Edwards said. And over time, those kinds of efforts have become standard across the National Football League. Harry dealt with anything that came to light in the organization that was dealing with race or things off the field, said Eric Wright, a former defensive back who played for the 49ers from 1981 through 1990. He helped the organization implement certain programs, financial literacy and encouraging players to go back and get their degrees. Harry implemented all of that. Wright said that because Edwards was working for the team, some players wrongly suspected that he was a management spy or apologist. They kind of felt he was positioned to be a mouthpiece for the organization, Wright said. He went through that with some of the players, but Harry's focal point was trying to uplift, to get the athlete on a successful path to be able to navigate life. Major League Baseball hired Edwards in 1987 to help develop a plan to increase the number of black managers and front office executives. At the time, MLB was scrambling to escape the fallout from the infamous comments then Dodgers Vice President and General Manager Al Campanis made several weeks earlier on the ABC News Nightline program. Asked why there were no black managers in baseball at the time, Campanis responded, "I truly believe that they may not have some of the necessities to be, let's say, a field manager or perhaps a general manager." It was a disaster that then-Commissioner Peter Uberoth asked Edwards to help mitigate. Peter called me and said, "Harry, I need some help on this. I want you to figure out a way to get us back on track from this Al Campanis fiasco," Edwards recalled. He noted that he had gotten to know Uberoth, a fellow San Jose State alum, through the years. Edwards reached out to, of all people, the disgraced Campanis. Edwards hired him as a consultant and asked Campanis to name the best black managerial candidate he knew. Campanis immediately recommended Dusty Baker, who had recently retired after a 19-year playing career, including 8 with the Dodgers. Edwards said he did not want Baker to work with the Dodgers for fear that the hire would look like a publicity stunt. Instead, they set up an interview for Baker with the San Francisco Giants, who ended up hiring Baker as a first base coach in 1988. Baker became manager for the Giants for the 1993 season. Then he was named National League Manager of the Year. Edwards also helped MLB develop a broader program to find minority candidates for managerial and front office jobs. Over the years, Edwards has developed a special bond with NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell. The two men met for the first time in 2006 during Goodell's early days as commissioner, sitting together in the owner's box at a 49ers game. They talked the entire game, Edwards said, and came to an understanding that he would be Goodell's eyes, ears, and voice and analytical mind dealing with issues that might impact the NFL. Since then, Edwards has been an informal advisor to the commissioner, sending him regular notes and emails about the league's potential role in addressing societal concerns. In a recent ESPN interview, Goodell said that Edwards' insights were particularly helpful in shaping the league's personal conduct policy and addressing player protests that surged during the peak of the Black Lives Matter movement. "Earlier in my time as commissioner, we took a stronger approach on discipline and player behavior. He was very helpful on that. The term he used to use with me all the time was the latter approach," Goodell said. "If a player or coach violated the league's personal conduct rules," he said, "you gave him an opportunity to take that ladder and climb out of it, but you had to earn your way back." During the wave of player protest, Goodell said many players were direct with him about the issues affecting their communities and what the NFL could do to address them. He said Edwards helped him better understand the life experiences players brought to the protests. "He was an incredible observer of people," Goodell said. "He's had a huge impact on me. He was very helpful to me in understanding a lot of deep issues that I previously may not have fully understood." Edwards said he has always appreciated the difficult role that Goodell plays as a commissioner. "He's the embodiment of the National Football League establishment, and must answer to the owners who employ him." Edwards credits Goodell for establishing initiatives such as societal justice awards for each team. He also calls the commissioner the driving force behind the league's Inspire Change initiative that has raised over $375 million for an array of community organizations over the past 7 years. At the same time, he knows critics often dismiss those efforts as performative and inconsequential for a sports league that generates more than $20 billion a year in revenue. In addition, Goodell was unable to persuade a team to sign Kaepernick after he became a free agent in 2017. Edwards said the commissioner helped arrange several potential tryouts for Kaepernick, but those efforts always broke down. At one point, Edwards said he suggested that Goodell hire Kaepernick as a league consultant. He said the commissioner quickly let him know that would not work. His first thing was, "Then who's going to hire me?" Edwards recalled. As Edwards has confronted the reality of his cancer diagnosis, He has written to a select group of people to express to them his admiration and respect. He said the letter start, "In case I'm not here when your tomorrow begins." Goodell was among the recipients. "It is a letter I will keep forever," Goodell said. Edwards is clear-eyed about his illness, as well as the challenges that he will one day leave behind. After all of his work to promise diversity, he is witnessing the federal government vilify and undermine those types of efforts. Yet he is not discouraged. He says he believes setbacks are inevitable and can be rendered temporary by continued activism. "There are no final victories," Edwards said. "There's just struggle. The only two things that survive are the struggle and the people, and they are perpetual." Edwards said he does not know who will lead that fight in the future. But that has always been the case, he noted. Few people would have predicted that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. would rise to prominence when he was a 26-year-old minister leading the Montgomery bus boycott. Nor did many people anticipate the Black Lives Matter movement sweeping the nation when it took shape more than a decade ago. Edwards said his own life on the front lines of modern sports activism would have been unthinkable when he was a young man growing up amid violent segregation and poverty in East St. Louis. Yet his work was able to transform how much of the world sees sports. "It's changed the way not just this society, but much of the world looked at sports," Edwards said. "It's changed the world's perceptions on the importance, influence, and impact of sports in modern societies. I think that's a contribution." That was the article, "Harry Edwards Isn't Done Just Yet." It was written by Michael A. Fletcher and published March 5th, 2025 at the ESPN.com website. My next article is from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. Its title is "Sidney Poitier's Bloodline, Legacy Live On in Metro Area." This was written by Mike Jordan and published February 24, 2025. The subtitle to the story is, "Actor's Love of Family Overcame an Aversion to the Deep South." Sidney Poitier wasn't initially a fan of Atlanta when he traveled through what was then Atlanta Municipal Airport in the 1950s. A recognizable star at the time, he arrived hungry in Atlanta after a flight from New York City. According to his daughter, my Aunt Pamela Poitier, he stopped at the Dobbs House, a restaurant near the airport's west gates. "He gets a little fame, comes through Atlanta, and the restaurant at the airport wouldn't serve him," Pam recalled. "He was told he'd be fed only if he agreed to sit behind a screen," she said. It was one of many racist experiences the Miami-born Bahamian movie star endured that made him avoid not just Atlanta, but the Southeast. In the biography, Sidney Poitier, The Long Journey by Carolyn H. Ewers, he said in 1961, "I have a particular aversion to the Deep South and I don't go around down there. I go other places." Despite those feelings, it would be love that kept him from staying away from Georgia thanks to a cluster of his family deciding to make Metro Atlanta their home. Beverly Henderson, the eldest of Poitier's four daughters with his first wife, Juanita, was not the first daughter to try living in Atlanta, but she was the first to visit the city on her own terms. In her mid-teens, while attending boarding school in Massachusetts, Aunt Bev learned that the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. had been killed in Memphis and remembers being devastated by the news. "A couple of friends and I felt we needed to be at the funeral to represent ourselves and our school. Her mother agreed. Her father did not. But after sharing her plans with Sidney, who was already in Atlanta for the memorial, he offered a deal. If you can figure out how to get there and don't do it on your own, you can go," he said. Aunt Bev and a friend found their way to Atlanta by bus, airplane, and train. They all went to Martin Luther King's funeral the next day. After a divorce, Beverly and her daughters, Camaria and Aisha, moved from Dallas, Texas to Atlanta, where she worked as a writer and producer for Turner Broadcasting System and the Trumpet Awards. She lives today with her husband Frank in Cartersville, Georgia. Aisha LaBerie works as an academic advisor at Georgia Tech. She fondly remembers holding court with Portier during family dinners at restaurants like Preachy and Vini Vidi Vici. No matter where we were, those meals were very cultural. Everybody talked. Everybody was present. Everybody was involved. Sidney Poitier's first wife, born Juanita Hardy, was born and raised in Bridgeport, Alabama, a small town on the border of Tennessee, 35 miles east of Chattanooga. Her lifelong friend, Frances Jean Walker, my grandmother, was raised directly across the street. The two ladies, now in their 90s, belong to families in Bridgeport who have been close for generations. They've lived together almost their entire lives, including today in Woodstock with my aunt, Sherry Portier. It was Sherry, Sydney's second youngest child with Juanita, who made the first attempt at living in Atlanta. She briefly moved here in the 1960s before determining she preferred the weather and work opportunities in Los Angeles. In 2001, she moved back to Atlanta to be closer to family. Sherry remembers advice from her father on being confident. He used to say, "Always look at people's pupils, straight in the eye." Gina Garage, who passed away in 2018, was the youngest daughter of Juanita and Sydney. She moved to Atlanta to attend the American College of Applied Arts, where she earned a degree in fashion merchandising and launched a short-lived clothing line with Macy's for plus-size women. Gina and her husband, Gaetan, had three children, Ghislaine and her younger brother and sister, Etienne and Gabrielle. Sydney always used to tell me, "If I can go from being an illiterate tomato farmer in the Bahamas to becoming one of the greatest black actors out there, you can do anything." That struck with me and helps me achieve my dreams of owning a company and doing something outside the norm, Ghislaine said. Pam, who lived in Atlanta for more than a decade around the 1990s, decided years ago to move to family land on Cat Island in the Bahamas, where she lives today after working with the King Center and for Zernona Clayton at Turner Broadcasting. She visits often but doesn't miss the city. "As for my relationship with Papa, it goes back to Bridgeport and my grandmother Frances, who we affectionately call Mama Jean. After becoming pregnant with my mother, she found herself alone when my maternal grandfather left Bridgeport unannounced and started a new life in Arkansas. My mother, born Constance Walker, was just starting elementary school when Mama Jean was asked by Juanita's mother to move to New York to help Juanita and Sydney raise their children. My grandmother agreed. My mother stayed with my great-grandmother in Bridgeport during the school year, and on the last school day of every year, she would fly out to be with the Portier family and travel the world like one of his daughters. Like Papa, Mom also died in 2022. He treated her so much like a daughter that he paid for her college education and visited Middle Tennessee State University when she became one of the first members of the school's chapter of Alpha Kappa Alpha. Today, around my neck, I wear a gold charm embedded with his fingerprint, which each of his daughters received months after his death, but she never got to wear. Papa not only loved my mother, but was very patient with me as I matured from a child into a married father with a successful career. I always believed he took a fancy to me because there were so many ladies in the family, and he appreciated having dude energy around. Today, a few days after what would have been his 98th birthday, it is a blessing to have so much family around. Happy belated birthday, Papa." That was the article, "Sidney Poitier's Bloodline, Legacy, Live On in Metro Area." This was written by Mike Jordan and published in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper on February 24, 2025. I'm going to wrap up this week's African American Hour with a book review. The title of the book being reviewed is "The Dead Are Arising, The Life of Malcolm X," written by Les Payne and Tamara Payne. The title of the book review is "Malcolm X's 1961 Trip to Atlanta, Key to Shift in Beliefs." This was written by Ernie Suggs and published February 21, 2025, in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. Malcolm X's bases of operations were generally Harlem, Chicago, and the Northeast. He rarely ventured south, but there was one memorable trip to Atlanta. Today, February 21st, marks the 60th anniversary of the death of Malcolm X, who has always been a strong cultural figure, often pitted as the opposite of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. Since at least the early 1990s, with the theatrical release of Spike Lee's Malcolm X, there has been renewed interest in Malcolm X's life through new scholarship. In 2012, historian Manning Marable won a Pulitzer Prize for his biography, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention, which carefully examined the civil rights leader in Waze 1965's The Autobiography of Malcolm X, as told to Alex Haley, did not. But in another Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Dead Are Rising, which came out in 2020, authors Les Payne and Tamara Payne, Les's daughter, detail a little-known 1961 trip to Atlanta at the behest of the head of the Nation of Islam to meet the leaders of the Ku Klux Klan. The secret, ill-fated meeting was shockingly embarrassing to Malcolm X, and it perhaps marked the first time he knew he had to leave the nation. In The Dead Are Arising, the Paynes revised Malcolm X's origin story with a meticulous and poignant retelling of his life from childhood through his time in the Nation of Islam. The book also exposed how his personal ambitions were shaped by racial trauma, guilt, and grief. In the book, the Paynes wrote the 1961 Atlanta trip began to shift Malcolm X's belief system. As recounted in the book, Malcolm X was sent to Atlanta by Nation of Islam leader Elijah Muhammad to talk with the Klan about building an all-black colony in Georgia. Both the Klan and the Nation of Islam favored separation of the races, and Muhammad, who was born in Georgia, thought the hate group might assist his organization in securing a large plot of land. The meeting was hosted in the home of an Atlanta-based member of the Nation named Jeremiah X, and through scattered government records, secret FBI surveillance, interviews, and personal diaries, the Paynes were able to piece together vivid details of the two-hour-long meeting that both the Nation and the Klan vowed to keep secret. Malcolm X never talked about it publicly, but it shook him. The Paynes wrote that the Klan seemed more interested in recruiting members of the Nation to help them kill King, whom they referred to as Martin Luther Coon. Les Payne died before the publication of the book, which earned him his second Pulitzer Prize. Payne, who had worked on the book for decades, wrote that the episode left Malcolm X deeply embarrassed, and it likely disheartened and shamed him as well. Malcolm X had been a public critic of King and rejected the Nobel Peace Prize winner's direction on race relations. The two never had a relationship, but met briefly enough in Washington, D.C. in 1964 to have a photo taken together. A year later, on February 5, 1965, just weeks before he was killed, Malcolm X visited with Coretta Scott King in Selma, Alabama, while King Jr. was in jail there for events leading up to Bloody Sunday. During his visit to Selma, he spoke at length to my wife, Coretta, about his personal struggles and expressed an interest in working more closely with the nonviolent movement. But he was not yet able to renounce violence and overcome the bitterness which life invested in him, King Jr. wrote in The Autobiography of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. There were also indications of an interest in politics as a way of dealing with the problems of the Negro. All of these were signs of a man of passion and zeal seeking for a program through which he could channel his talents. During that 1961 meeting with the Klan, it did not escape Malcolm's notice that, in contrast to the Christian Reverend King, the black Muslims drew not a jot of ire from the one white group in America that was universally despised as devils by all black people, including Malcolm himself, the Paynes wrote. In fact, the Klan was regarding him and Jeremiah, two key ministers of Elijah Muhammad's black Muslims, as potential allies. Muhammad had warned his negotiators about Klan skullduggery, but not even Muhammad had anticipated such a cold-blooded request for a joint venture against King. The starkness of the request left Malcolm reeling. The book goes on to say that the episode and Muhammad's willingness to overlook the long bloody history, as well as the mounting terror of the Klan, struck Malcolm X on a deeply personal level. Malcolm X converted to Islam in the 1950s while in prison for burglary. After his release from prison, the popular narrative of his life suggests he completely embraced Muhammad and the Nation of Islam, which he used as a foundation to launch some of the era's harshest critiques of white America and racism. But after his 1964 pilgrimage to Mecca, just 3 years after his trip to Atlanta, Malcolm X transformed his worldview, rejected the racially divisive Nation of Islam, and changed his name to El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz. He spent the rest of his life trying to build a new organization while fighting off what he said were death threats from the Nation of Islam. 4 years after the meeting with the Klan, Malcolm X was assassinated on February 21, 1965, by men affiliated with the Nation of Islam during an Organization of Afro-American Unity meeting in Manhattan's Audubon Ballroom. His death, sandwiched between the 1963 assassination of John F. Kennedy and the 1968 murders of Robert F. Kennedy and King, left a gaping hole in the so-called black militant movement, while elevating Malcolm X, as he stated in his autobiography, into a martyr. Three men were arrested and convicted in the killing, but after spending more than 20 years in prison, two of them, Muhammad A. Aziz and Khalil Islam, were exonerated. The third, Thomas Hagen, was paroled in 2010. That was the book review titled, Malcolm X's 1961 Trip to Atlanta, Key to Shift in Beliefs. It was written by Ernie Suggs and published February 21st, 2025 in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. It was a review of the book, The Dead Are Arising, The Life of Malcolm X, written by Les Payne and Tamara Payne. That's all the time we have this week. If you would like to listen to this program again or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcasts or at the Audio Reader website at reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.